And this is Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Peter Payette. I'm joined now by Jerry Dennis. Jerry is a writer from Traverse City who's been writing about the Great Lakes region for a few decades now. His newest book is an extended meditation on the lakes in wintertime. It's called Windward Shore, A Winter on the Great Lakes. It's published by University of Michigan Press. At the front, he suggests the lakes might be the most poorly understood place in North America. So with the help of an injured knee to slow him down a little bit, he devotes himself to understanding them better. And Jerry's here with us in the studio. Hello, Jerry.
Hello, Peter.
Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
So as I say at the opening, you say the lakes are pretty poorly understood for a variety of reasons. You kind of wax poetic that they're so large, they're overlooked, they're so familiar, they're invisible, and you put it a few more ways. So tell us a little bit about what you mean.
Well, any of us who've met people who aren't from around here, who are not familiar with the lakes, have had the experience of seeing how surprised they are when you mention that you can't see across the lakes. And I've heard that so many times from so many people from so many different parts of the world and from different walks of life that I became kind of intrigued by that whole concept and started making a point wherever I travel to ask people, you know, what do you think of when you think of the Great Lakes? And most often they say, I think of that river that caught fire, and they're referring to the Cuyahoga in Cleveland. They think of the lakes as hopelessly polluted very often. And then invariably they think of them as lakes. And when I mentioned that you can't see across any of the Great Lakes, even the smallest, Lake Erie, they're invariably shocked and surprised. And you see that very dramatically when somebody comes to visit for the first time and they just can't believe their eyes. A friend of mine hosted a group of Japanese scholars who came to the region for a conference, and he took them around Leelanau County. And at various stops along the way, they would stop to get out and look at the lake. And at each one of those stops, these Japanese people would go right down to the water and taste it because they couldn't believe that it was fresh. They had never seen such an enormous body of water that was not salty. I saw that so much that I really began thinking about it and wondering, okay, why? What's the problem here? And came up with a few ideas. I think one of the problems is that the lakes are just so immense. They cover such a huge area and so many different kinds of country, so many different kinds of ecoregions and cities, so many varieties of shoreline, from industrial to residential to almost true wilderness. Nobody can really quite get their heads around that. People who live on Lake Ontario have no more understanding of Lake Michigan than they do of Arizona. It seems as remote to them as that, and vice versa. We in Michigan aren't too familiar with the Lake Ontario shore at all, and it seems like it is a long way away. It's a heck of a drive.
Yeah, I keep hoping to get up to Superior sometime, and have a visit, which if I'm lucky, I do once a year. But you have some colorful stories about some shocking ignorance about the lakes right at the front of your book. Maybe share one of those and then why you included those in your account of all this.
Well, I'm guessing you're talking about whale watching on Lake Michigan.
That was the one. I mean, the other was quite simple, and that was a woman who had grown up
in
Escanaba and thought that the water down at the beach was Lake Superior.
And she argued that it was Lake Superior, and my friend had to show her a map, and she was shocked. And she'd lived in Escanaba for 18 years.
But the other was this textbook.
And that became is very iconic, I think, of misunderstandings about the Great Lakes. This national magazine headquartered in Arizona that puts out weekly studies magazine for elementary school students decided that they had never done a story about the Great Lakes, so it was time to do a story. So they put their researchers to work on it. And they stumbled across a website that someone with a lot of time on their hands had created as a hoax, called Whale Watching in Lake Michigan. And they really did it. It was a very convincing job. I'll grant them that. It talked about how the whales migrated down from Hudson Bay every spring and made their way to southern Lake Michigan, where they bred. They fed on salmon and alewives and zebra mussels and bred and sported around, had a great life, and then headed back up to Hudson Bay. Well, this magazine not only bought it hook, line, and sinker, but they made it their cover story and were very proud of it. And it went out across the country. And I was a teacher in Muskegon was reading it up to her students as she did every week. And she said, wait a minute, there aren't any whales in Lake Michigan. So she took it upon herself to call the magazine, and they argued with her. They said, we stand behind our story. And of course, you eventually got them to back down and print a retraction.
So is this, and you included these because this is a extreme expression of this general ignorance, or there's something else going on?
Well, that's pretty extreme. That is pretty extreme. But there is a lot of misunderstandings, and I think that has some serious consequences. One is that it's very tough to get legislation passed to protect the Great Lakes. It's very hard to get people to care who aren't directly affected. I mean, there's 36 million of us in the watershed, and we care, and we care, many of us, passionately. But outside of the watershed, no, they think of it as either already a lost cause or too remote for their understanding to care about. So it's, you know, I've kind of set out for the last two books to see if I can't make a dent in that misunderstanding.
And the point that you make that was of the most interest to me, and maybe this should be your next book, was you say there's no clear mythology that goes with the lakes like there is with the, you know, the Rockies. Or I lived in Maine for a while, and you mentioned Maine as having this kind of ethos. And it's very true that everyone in Maine kind of, especially along the coast, has that sort of salty, you know, Mainer kind of identity that seems to go with the place. And even I was in on Cape Cod last spring, and it's similar there. I mean, it just is more palpable where it is sort of missing in the Great Lakes, and that's something you touch on here and there in this book.
It is missing, and it, for I'm sure a lot of reasons. One, again, is that there is such a variety of landscapes around the Great Lakes, from the enormous farming regions of the Southern Lakes to the industrial cities of the Rust Belt to our northern boreal forests that across the upper lakes that are among the most remarkable and forests in North America. We can't really get our minds wrapped around what the identity of the lakes as a whole are. Within certain regions, it's there. The North Shore of Lake Superior in Minnesota is very wrapped up in it. They capitalize on it. They use it for marketing purposes, just like Texans do and Maine business people do. They want to propagate this mythology of moose and wolf and canoes, which is beautiful and wonderful, and it's very true to their history. But you can't really do that for the whole lakes as a whole, because, or as the lakes as a whole, because there's too many small mythologies, and they all kind of blend in together and become nothing.
Right. They're just too vast. Let me say, you're listening to Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm talking with Jerry Dennis, a writer from Traverse City. He has a new book called Windward Shore: A Winter on the Great Lakes. If you would like to join in our conversation this morning, you could do it at 800-681.
This edition of Points North was recorded earlier. Please, no phone calls at this time.
So by the end of this book, we find the author at the beach looking at a rock, and you're contemplating what you actually know about this rock, and you decide it's so little, how could you expect to know anything about the greater landscape that it's a part of? And then you decide in your frustration and your ignorance, you chuck the rock. I wonder if you could expand a little bit on what you feel ignorant about, given that you probably know more about these lakes than most any of us.
Well, for whatever reason, I find it very hard to get beyond the fact that we're incredibly ignorant about just about everything, and it's, you know, starting with what we're doing on this bigger rock. And working on this book raised a lot more questions for me than it answered. And one of them was this idea of knowledge and how limited our knowledge is and what hope there is for us to learn enough about ourselves and our immediate surroundings to have a better understanding of our place in the universe. So that was really what was behind much of the book, actually. And the throwing of the rock felt pretty darn good, I have to say. That's one thing we know we can count on in the physical world, is that we can pick up an object. We might not understand this object. We can't see the particles that it's made of that, incidentally, now we learn could potentially be traveling at faster than the speed of light. We don't understand really what this rock is, what it's made out of. We can't really relate to the many cultures around the world through history that have thought of rock as a living thing. But we can pick this rock up and hold it and appreciate it and see beauty in it. And then if we feel like it, give it a good fling into the lake and watch the splash it makes.
And when you say that, you know, your motivation or the purpose behind the book, I was interested on the jacket. Maud Barlow says this is she's a Canadian activist, water rights activist, involved in a lot of environmental issues. She calls this a gentle call to action to save the lakes, which I didn't really read it that way. I didn't get that from it. Is that how you saw what you were doing?
In a way, that's part of what I've been doing. This is part of what I did with the Living Great Lakes as well. I feel like my role in that realm is to make gentle pleas for action. I'm not going to stand up on a soapbox and shout that it needs to be done. I'm hoping to appeal to people's hearts more than minds. Maud is very effective at appealing to reason. And she's very effective at that. She stands up in front of a crowd and people are riveted by her intellect. She's very bright. She's very informed. That's not my strength. That's not what I'm particularly interested in, but in doing it personally. So I think she was seeing a little bit what she wanted to see, maybe. But there's no doubt that's part of my motivation for these books, is I want to raise awareness about them so that people will care. And if they care, then maybe they'll take action.
Well, let's take a phone call. Lois in Traverse City. Good morning, Lois. You're on Points North.
Yes, I have just a couple of comments. I have been a Michigander my whole life. I love Michigan, and I just can't live without the water around me. And my concern is that so much of the Great Lakes is being bought up by private owners, industries, and the lakeshore is losing its natural character for the public to enjoy. How can we get people from other states and countries to come and visit if the viewing is very small? Example, you go up to Empire, and that used to be a free beach, and now, you know, anybody that goes near there, you have to pay a fee. I know that things need to be maintained, but there's so many people that live and work and weave in their lives in and out of the Great Lakes, even just to go have lunch in a mini lunch vacation at the water, to have to pay a fee, a $5 fee, is a travesty for the local community. And I just hope that we can still keep the public area of the beaches and the lakes free to the public. And also, you know, the health of our dogs, they need to run free. They can scale an acre in seconds. And we need to have a place where the dogs can go and lap up that water and have some freedom to run without somebody being frightened. I've been down to Austin, in the middle of Austin, Texas, where they have dog parks open right down by the river, and you see hundreds of dogs and people milling around together, and there isn't any fights because it's nobody's territory. So I'm just promoting some of that.
Hey, thanks for the call, Lois.
Thank you very much.
You know, in your book, Jerry, you're often hanging out at private beaches. In fact, friends with cottages. But what do you think about what Lois says?
Well, her concerns are valid, absolutely. It's a trade-off many times, and she's talking about the shoreline of Sleeping Bear National Lakeshore, where, yes, there's a fee to be paid, but that's the trade-off for having it as a national park. If it wasn't a national park, it would be private, and it would be very difficult to find access to the lakes. We're very lucky in the Great Lakes region in Michigan because our state Supreme Court made it law that we have the right to walk anywhere on the shore of the Michigan shores of the Great Lakes. We can't walk across somebody's property to get to the shore without permission, but if there's an access site like the beach in Empire, we can walk anywhere we want along that immediate shoreline and all the way around the lake virtually if we chose to. But it's a complicated issue. You know, the idea of the Great Lakes as a commons is one that has a great amount of appeal to me and to many other people. Jim Olson and his organization Flow are doing tireless work to ensure that someday this water will be declared common, belonging to all of us, as does the air. And that's only common sense, it seems to me.
It's an uphill battle, though.
But it's an uphill battle, absolutely. There are a lot of people who want a piece of it.
So going back to the rock and this moment where you realize you know very little about all these things, you then, it seemed to me, take some comfort in a term that you introduced earlier in the book that comes from bumper stickers up in the UP that are fairly common. And the word, is it a Finnish word?
Mm-hmm.
Sisu?
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about where you've seen these and what they mean and what it now means to you.
Well, you'll see it on bumper stickers all through the UP. I called it the unofficial Uper anthem. I became aware of it first when I lived in Marquette in the late 1970s, and I happened to be there during the winter of 78, 79. My wife and I and our first son was born that winter, which was the winter with the coldest temperature and most snowfall of the last 100 years. And we got to see firsthand how hardy people in the UP are and have to be to survive and thrive in weather like that. So at the beginning of the book, I saw that while staying on the Keweenaw Peninsula. I saw that as the reason these people can live in such a harsh area. I mean, there are a lot of more harsh places in the world, but that one's pretty harsh. It's very cold in the winter, and there's a lot of mosquitoes and black flies in the summer, and you don't see people complain. When I lived in Marquette, I worked for the railroad for a while, and I was laying track in November, and it was cold. It was harsh cold, and I was working with a crew of Upers, and I paid close attention. I never once heard anybody complain. And our hands were cracking, our lips were cracking in the cold. Nobody once complained. It's a pretty interesting point of view.
And had you come across the word sisu at that time, or only more recently?
No, I first became aware of it then because I'd see it on bumper stickers. But there was no explanation; just a small, very small bumper sticker that just said this one word, sisu, and you didn't know if it was an acronym or what. And all it is a reminder to them, you know, buck up, don't complain, buck up.
And you see it as commonly now?
Actually, no. I haven't seen it nearly as much as I used to, and I'm not sure why.
And when you inquire about its meaning, how do they explain it?
Guts, fortitude. But you know, it's the one thing that really interests me about it. It's not the macho version. It's not like our word guts, you know, is one taken on by soldiers and athletes more often than not. It's got masculine connotations, but sisu, I mean, the women of the UP were the ones that I saw carrying it with the most dignity. They were out hard at work in weather of all kinds, and you know, I wrote a story once about an incident in Marquette during that terrible winter, during a blizzard that was an unbelievable blizzard. It closed down the whole state of Michigan virtually, and in the UP, no, you couldn't go anywhere. Marquette, the state police barricaded the roads in and out of Marquette. They would not let anybody out for 2 days. And in the midst of that that terrible storm, when you could virtually not see across the street, we lived in a house right in Marquette, could not see across the street. The drifts were as high as our windows. Our car was buried in a drift. Bang, 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 there came a knock on our door, and I opened it up, and it's two Finnish ladies bundled up in their coats with headscarves on. And I said, yes. And they said, we're collecting for the United Way. They were out walking down the street, house to house, in this worst blizzard I'd ever seen. So, yeah.
And so how do you connect that concept to your to the rock and your epistemological problems?
Well, if we don't know the most fundamental things about our existence, how do you live? How do you conduct yourself in life? And that's absolutely one of the guiding principles, is to buck up, is to have courage in the face of adversity and uncertainty. And I just saw that at that moment as a very, very valid life philosophy.
So your last book, much of it is from the deck of the Malabar, as you travel the lakes. And in the past, you've written a lot about paddling and fly fishing. So here you chose winter. What did you learn from observing or thinking about the Great Lakes in that season?
What appealed to me, it's winter has always been one of my favorite seasons. Fall and winter are the two favorite. And I think part of the reason is that in winter it's easier to slow down and to reflect on things. And part of the reason I wanted to do this book was that I had reached a point which a lot of people I know have reached, where I was tired of the clamor around me. I was tired of the pace. I was tired of the constant chatter on every form of medium. And I just said, okay, I'm going to take a winter and I'm going to unplug and I'm going to read a lot of books and I'm going to think a lot. I'm going to tend fires in the fireplace and wood stoves, and I'm going to walk as much as I can along the shore and see if I can understand things about the Great Lakes that I've missed. Part of it also was that while working on the Living Great Lakes and sailing and paddling and motorboating through the lakes, I saw a lot of places I wanted to return to. So this was a chance to go back to places like the Keweenaw and settle in for a while and spend some time and get to know it a little better.
The one observation you make about wintertime, I think you're standing on a deck up near Northport with binoculars looking out on the lake, and you say that that doesn't have much to say about people at this time of year, that it is sort of the time when people are not welcome, or I don't know. What did you mean there?
Yeah, we sometimes can forget that. The summers are busy, and often, we can go days without finding a place where there aren't any people. That isn't really a problem for me. What I found interesting about that experience was that when you're standing on the shore of an immense body of water and you can't see any people or boats or any other sign of humanity in across 20 miles of open waters to the horizon and down 10 miles one way of the beach and 10 miles down the other way, the sense comes back that, this isn't all about us. And there's something very comforting and calming about that. We do tend to think of ourselves a lot more than maybe we need to. And it feels good to get out into places where we're pretty irrelevant, where it's getting along really well without us, just fine without us. I made the point at one point in the book that we can't live without nature, but it gets along pretty well without us. And that's the sense that I got out of those places in winter, in this season when it is possible to feel like you're alone and also feel like this place is yours in a way.
And at one point you observe your interactions with people you do bump into are different than they would be in the summertime, or at least in one instance.
Yeah, and there were several instances like that where a woman I saw walking down the beach, just about every day past the house where I was staying on Cathead Point near Northport. And she was the only person I would see most days. We had a few It was mild January, and there were a few people out on the weekends. But during the weekdays, she was the only one I would see. And one day, my wife and I were walking down the beach, and we met her coming the other way. And I sensed right away that, I mean, she was cordial, but I sensed right away she was a little disappointed to have to share it with us. And I thought, well, in the summer when you meet people from elsewhere, tourists who are just here, there's a kind of distance between you that's a little different than this one, because this woman had a real bond with Gail and me, but yet we were also distant from each other because we weren't necessarily sure we wanted to share it with her.
So next week you're going to have your Horizon Books next week?
Yeah, Friday, September 30th is the launch party.
All right. And then what are you going to do next?
Well, I'll be traveling a lot through the fall to speak at universities and talk about the book at bookstores, of course. I just finished another book with Glenn Wolf and I. We've been working on this for quite a while. It's a book of essays about wildlife that began as a column we wrote for Wildlife Conservation Magazine at the Bronx Zoo many years ago. We wrote it through the 90s. And since then, we've just sort of tinkered with them and expanded them somewhat. And Glenn's illustrations are gorgeous and beautiful, as always. All his work is. And we're real happy with this book. And just this week, it sent it out to publishers.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Jerry, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
That's Jerry Dennis. His newest book is called Windward Shore, A Winter on the Great Lakes, published by University of Michigan Press. This has been Points North on Interlochen Public Radio. Thanks to Bob Allen and Jack Connors for helping me produce the show. John Wunsch composed and performed this theme. Tom Paulson is the general manager of Interlochen Public Radio. You can find us online at ipr.interlochen.org/pointsnorth. I'm Peter Payette. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.